Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Welcome to the SDF conferencing system. One other party is in this conference.
From the depths of Lake Michigan, remote viewing from Chicago's northwest side, this is Vintage Cop with Jazz Maz, exclusively on Anon Radio. Now, here's Jazz.
There are two other parties in this conference.
Hello, hello. Well, hello, this is Jazz Maz with, I guess, Vintage Compu Talk tonight on Open VoIP. Perhaps SMJ will join us in a few minutes, or perhaps others. Or perhaps I'm on the wrong conference bridge, since that's been known to happen from time to time. I guess I could listen into the stream. I guess I will see if I can hear myself. myself on the stream.
Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Yeah, it looks like I am, in fact, live. Or I should say, sounds like I am, in fact, live. So, as is unfortunately usual, I don't really have much prepared. I suspect that maybe SMJ is late in joining us, because I think he is supposed to be putting together some type of display or presentation for the Seattle Retro Computing Society. I believe he had mentioned before that tomorrow is a meeting, and he was intending on bringing something and attending. So, we'll see. I think there was some talk about possibly the DECGG, which is an interesting terminal put up by Digital Equipment Corporation. It seems to be a little bit of a hybrid terminal slash almost home computer-like in the fact that it has an internal basic interpreter and can be used to basically do bitmap graphics and line drawing on the screen. Which I guess used a back-end referred to as Regis, which I think the documentation refers to as, I can't remember it, but essentially I guess it extends the escape character set that was typical of various DEC terminals and other terminals of the day to implement a graphic sort of language. Or at least, you know, control language kind of thing. Yeah, and the other thing that was sort of interesting about it is that that the graphic interface could be either programmed locally by the basic interpreter, you know, but through programming in BASIC, or from, I guess, the serial, either from, you know, a host machine or some other type of system, basically. Also, I find it interesting that, I guess, the serial has both RS-232 and current loop, considering the time frame that you figure current loop interfaces might have been becoming less common by the time that the GG hits the market space. But it looks something kind of, like I said, a hybrid between a terminal and almost like a home computer, except, of course, you know, the, I guess, system design was much broader.
There are three other parties in this conference.
There's supposed to be a suite of host-controlled applications for education and other sort of things. Hello, welcome, new caller.
Hi, Jasmine. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Well, I'm very good, and I'm hoping to be listening something about the digital equipment GG.
Yeah. It was interesting because there were a couple of them at the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest, and SMJ pointed out that the SDF Twinix project at twinix.org actually has the host side of that system in some capacity. So it was sort of like, I don't know, I would kind of describe it kind of like a cross between, you know, DEC's take on on a computer-assisted learning teaching system, kind of like what Plato was, conceivably, I guess. And as well as, I also remember the Waterloo Systems Project produced the Waterloo Machine that was supposed to kind of be a way of doing local programming on a small microcomputer and being able to sort of interchange data and programs on, you know, between it and a host machine that was usually, you know, a mainframe or a miniframe, you know, mini computer. The Super Pet being an example, a commercial example of the Waterloo Machine.
Great, that's nice, and I think it's a great opportunity to know something about those great time sharing systems of the past.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't own a GG. I don't have one in my collection. Wasn't really totally aware of them until I got a little introduction to them at the last show. SMJ talked about it, and Jason T. at the show talked a little bit about them as well, from, you know, what his knowledge was, that he thought that the back-end software was largely missing. But that appears not to be the case. So I'd been tinkering with, in the past week, the MAME emulator. They actually have emulators for various classic terminals and computers. What was originally the MES project portion of that emulation system. Still kind of poking around on that. I still haven't gotten the back-end communication working correctly with it. But I can get the local BASIC running on it, so that's kind of interesting.
Well, you can start to sort things out in those machines.
Yeah.
Perhaps the most easily way to compare that is like a BT-100, but with many additional capabilities.
Yeah.
In the GG.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting about it, too, is that when you change the terminal emulation mode on it, it's actually ANSI and not VT-102 or VT-100, to give you an idea as to the time frame in which it was released, that there was essentially a formal standard for terminal operations under an ANSI specification, and I guess it is functionally a subset of VT-100 with I don't know if the color is strictly VT-102 off the top of my head, or if it is a different set of escape sequences for that. All I remember is back in the BBS days, you know, ANSI color was a big deal. Although I know people that don't particularly like all the colorification of the old terminals and character based graphics, that it gets a little out of hand fast. I had a friend joke about the Lynx terminal browser, Lynx with a Y. That the default color scheme looks like, you know, he made the comment that the default color scheme looks like anything that, when color was introduced, that you must use every single color available on the screen all at once.
Well, I remember they were like 16
Open
colors.
Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Only 8 if they can, because in order to keep compatibility with like old time systems and
yeah.
Like.
Yeah, because not necessarily every color terminal had 16 colors, and some of them were not even color, but may have had multiple intensity levels, maybe 3 or 4, right? Yeah, maybe if we get lucky, maybe SMJ will get on the line at some point and tell us about what he's hoping to show off at the retro computer gathering he is intending to be at tomorrow. Or at least that was the plan the other week when I talked with him.
Oh, okay, I hope so. It's a nice connoisseur of all these.
Yeah, it's also nice that, you know, people can meet in person once again with, you know, some with only minor precautions.
Yeah, of course. I'm trying here to make work really old Commodore 64 I've been given, but I'm not giving any chance of success because suddenly the power supply is broken.
That's too bad.
Because these parts are perhaps the important to start the
although
computer.
There's not a lot remarkable about the Commodore 64 power supply that if you've got, I guess the question is it the actual transformer or is it the regulation and filtering in the machine?
Well, I'm afraid it's the... perhaps are both, because I have two pulses.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes it happens, right? The transformer and the primary rectification and filtering fail on you, and then it kills the regulation side of it.
Yeah, the thing is, like, it goes like this. Here we use 220 volts, so perhaps the machine was tuned to 110, and someone tried the other voltage and blew everything.
Yeah, that suddenly instead of a 5-volt DC and 12-volt or 9-volt AC system, you now have a 10-volt DC system and 18-volt AC system, right, going into regulation.
Yeah.
That's just... yeah, on the AC side, that would probably kill the CIAs, and probably just too much for the 5-volt regulator to sink down.
In any case, it's not an expensive machine either, but it had a sentimental value for some people.
Sure. It's not like they're uncommon, let's put it that way, that you'll probably have the opportunity to get another one or find the parts to repair that one.
Yeah, they are very common.
Yeah. But yeah, voltage differences are always a bit of a problem. It's like I have in my collection a Commodore 1551 disk drive, and that was only, I think, sold in Germany, possibly other parts of Europe.
That was the early model?
That was a late model. That was the model that was designed for the Commodore Plus 4 and the other TED line of machines. So it has a weird cartridge-based interface. that is a Commodore triport interface on either end of it, you know, on the disk drive end of it, and on the host end of it in the cartridge. And it has, I guess, a 4-bit interface, but it's only transmitting 3 bits of data at a time. So it's faster than a stock 1541, but not quite as fast as a PET IEEE drive. But yeah, those needed to be adjusted for U.S. current. I think in my case, I think there was a different set of taps on the transformer, and then maybe you had to change some of the components of the regulation. Someone else did the modification, so I don't know firsthand.
Yeah, we'll try that, and I will see how it goes. But most of the time, it's just...
Right, the Commodore power supplies are epoxied bricks, so you're going to probably need to find...
Just a huge brick, white brick, remember?
Yeah.
It's like 3 pounds in weight, something
Yeah,
like that.
They're just filled, they're filled with epoxy resin, so they're not serviceable in any way. Unless you have like a 128 power supply, those were serviceable. Although they have a different style power connector on them. And then of course there were heavy duty power supplies marketed, some aftermarket, some by Commodore, like for the Commodore memory expansion, the 1764 256K memory expansion. It required a heavy-duty power supply, so came with what was essentially a Commodore 128 power supply with the appropriate, you know, DIN connector on it for the C64. So, yeah, so in the case of, like, I don't know what the... power standard is down there. You said it was what?
Well, it was 220 volts and
yeah.
50 hertz.
220 volts, 50 hertz. And that's AC or DC?
Well, it's AC.
It is AC, okay.
So, in any case, you got to some sort of different clock speed in the CPU because of the different power cycles.
Right. Although that's important for the video, and to a lesser extent important if you're going to use the time of day clocks on the CIAs.
The video is exchanged. It is not the same. It's a norm called PAL instead of NTSC. So in any case, they changed the PAL color system in these units.
Mm-hmm.
They included in the board, and they changed that by another model. I don't know exactly the
So it's probably got an NTSC chip in it rather than PAL chip in it?
I'm not sure. I have to disassemble the unit and check because...
Yeah, check the part number on the VIC chip and the VIC-2 chip and see if it's PAL or NTSC.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's where the frequency, of the power system is going to matter, because that's going to...
Because the models which were sold in Argentina in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
they changed the video terminal and the video component.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that the NSTC versions, if you connect that into a Apple TV, you got the image, but you got it in black and white. You don't get any color.
Right.
But it works, in any case. But this unit is dead, so...
Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Perhaps changing components with another C64, or I don't know what I'm going to do. But I don't even have the brick.
Right, you would need to replace if the power supply is bad. You'd need a replacement power supply. If it's still functioning, you would still minimally need a transformer adapter to go from the 220 to 110.
So, in any case,
In
the worst case scenario, I still have some spare parts.
Mm-hmm.
Turn it into parts.
Mm-hmm.
It is not also a bad idea if I can make it work. But
you can make the Commodore people angry, and you can just pull the SID chip out and throw the rest of it in the trash.
Yeah.
Which sadly is a thing.
There are plenty of parts of this computer because they were so common back then.
Yeah.
And, well, they gave me this old computer who was not working. And also an Epson compatible printer with the old time line printer with 9 pins.
Is it a dot matrix
dot matrix. And
yeah.
All the slow one because.
Yeah, like an FX or MX80 or something like that.
Yeah, the small brown unit, is something like M. 803 or something like that. It's
yeah.
Model of 603, and it works because you can do the test page, and it's incredibly slow. I didn't remember how slow it was, but it is slow.
Yeah. Dot matrix is not really known for being high speed printers. They were just sort of stopgap method of getting halftone images and sort of pixel images, pixel art on a page, and you could also do some halftoning effects as well.
Well, it took like 3 minutes to print all the columns in one page.
So really?
Yeah, something like that.
Wow.
So, it's not the fastest printed ever, and you know why? Can't say why the printer is the most perhaps hated of all these components in the computers. in these retro computers events that you share over there, you have printers.
I still have some classic printers. I think I've even got one hiding somewhere that might actually have a SCSI interface on it, of all bizarre things, but I guess those did exist. I mean, there was a printer specification for the original SCSI standard. But yeah, I still have a few. I think I might still have like a Sears SR1000, which was a dual interfaced printer. I gave away a couple of them, sold a couple of them that I had. I had gotten a collection of stuff from a guy who ended up getting the collections of a lot of people from his local area over time that left the hobby. Or I shouldn't say left the hobby. Upgraded beyond the Commodore 8-bit stuff and gave the stuff to him. And at some point he needed to clear it out, so I went and got it and redistributed a lot of that stuff back into the collecting community. And in there was a number of Sears SR1000 printers, and they had... there were dual interface printers. They had, the typical Centronics parallel connector on them, as well as a Commodore IEC-style serial interface.
Oh, great. So there's still place in some people's hearts from these kind of old printers.
Yeah, and some of the plotters and things like that. I think Tim Brain found a way to dump the ROM code out, mask ROM code out of one of the Commodore plotters that was not readily available at one point in time because it was, it's mask ROM programmed and you don't typically have direct user access to it. I think he did that by getting it into a debugging mode and being able to, do some sort of something like direct memory access programming of the small amount of RAM in it to basically dump the data out an I/O pin somewhere.
So he's going to hack the brains of an old plotter.
Yeah. I think that was a, 6809 microcontroller, which was a cost-reduced, not fully pinned-out version of a 6502 with a little bit of memory and a mask ROM. So they were sort of application-specific.
Yeah. I remember in the 80s, one of my friends got the... what it was called here, the Apis Optico or optical pen or light pen, I don't know the exact name in English. And it was such cool, but he used that on a Commodore monitor who was at the time very scarce in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
And we used that regular TV, and it worked too in the regular TV.
Yeah.
So it worked with any kind of CRT device.
Yeah, I mean, so long as it's a scanning CRT, it should work to some degree. I know I have a couple of light pens for the Commodore 64, and all they are really just photo detectors in a pen, essentially, and basically. The video chip produces signals that it can detect and cause an interrupt and then do some processing. I've got a few of them. I haven't really put them to use, though. I've been meaning to try them with, like, GEOS, which actually supports them as a pointing device. And then, of course, I think there's some graphic, art programs that will use them as a...
Yeah, we use it. I don't remember the exact name, but it's perhaps it was something like Koala Paint.
Yeah, Koala Paint probably supported a light pen. I know they had their own tablet as well.
Because you got the software. Obviously, the software we had was...
Yeah, so I have some Koala tablets in my collection, and probably some copies of Koala Paint with it. But my guess is they would probably have also supported light pen as well.
Yeah, because in the program they say something about the Koala tablet or Koala paddle or something.
Yeah,
like
the
that.
Koala pad I think is the product name. Yeah,
but obviously as the program was illegal copy. We didn't have but the light pen was available, and I don't know if it was the correct, brand for this program. But in any case, it worked, and
yeah.
It was cool at the time to draw in the screen.
Yeah.
Today you can do it with a phone with your own finger, but at the time it was wow.
Yep.
Computer track the pen. And, it was cool back then.
Yeah, there were also a couple of games that that came with a light gun, which actually used the light pen interface. A far more sophisticated arrangement than, say, for instance, the Pixel Blaster on the Nintendo Entertainment System. Because I think the, as I recall, the Pixel Blaster on the NES was not, you know, not a light pen type interface. It was just a photo sensor, like a cadmium sensor. Because I remember I was able to trick it that if you pulled the trigger at the right time and just flashed any light into the actual barrel, as long as you got the timing right, it would trigger a hit, regardless of where the gun was actually pointed.
So
and the way I think it worked was, is they would reverse video flash the white pixels around the object that was the target on the screen, which would, you know, basically cause a slight flash of light that could be detected. You know, it was bright enough to be detected by the photo cell. down the barrel of the Pixel Blaster gun. But that was an interesting.
Everyone was aiming a gun to the TV.
Yeah, well, the idea was you would aim it at the TV. The TV would flash at the gun. Just a small area around the object that you're supposed to, that is your target, and it would just detect that. I mean, technically speaking, you know, the typical white pen is like that, but it's, you know, on a much finer scale.
Yeah, later I can remember there was some sort of video game from a company called American Laser Games.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a Western shooter, but with a movie, a video movie. I don't know if you remember that or you played that.
I remember there was a Laserdisc game that was sort of a shooter game, like, you know, Western shooter game like that, that actually had, you know, actual,
actors.
Film footage of real actors on it.
So
maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Yes, I don't remember exactly the name, but it was like.
Mm-hmm. There may have been other variations on that game before that too, that may have used other types of display technology to kind of. Actually, I think I remember some other games earlier on that were kind of like that were pre-Laserdisc, that may have had some type of film projection system or. You know, some sort of like reverse, rear projection video system or something like that.
Yeah, it was such a cool technology,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know if they was trying in the Commodore Amiga too. But in any case, for us, the first time
mm-hmm.
I saw that was in the 64, in the Commodore 64,
right?
Like in the late 80s or mid 80s.
Yeah, I'm not sure too much how much. I suspect that they probably would have had an optical, you know, pen interface to the graphics chipset for the Amiga stuff, just simply because it was kind of something they'd already engineered on other levels. But I don't know that that was ever really popular by then. I think it, you know, kind of hit its fad. I mean, the interesting thing about the light pen technology was, you know, it's sort of a totally intuitive sort of way of manipulating information and data on screen. Ergonomically, it's a little brutal on your elbow and shoulder and wrist over time.
Well, I can remember also another computer who was very quiet, at least revolutionary at the time. It was a, like 1979 computer
mm-hmm.
in Australia, who was essentially a sound sampler. You got the ability to record sound.
Uh-huh.
The Firelight CMI, it was called. And you have an optical pen.
Mm-hmm.
And you can insert notes, and you also have a keyboard, and well, you can essentially do what a digital audio workstation do today.
Mm-hmm.
put notes into the screen and then it play back like in a synthesizer or a sampler.
Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Yeah, I'm sure.
A nice, extremely expensive computer, and very, very well known in the 80s as a producing machine. And but it, I don't know if it, they kept the optical pen into the later models, but it was just an interesting thing of the first model, and then the people said, okay, no, it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Let's just keep the keyboard, and with that, you are already done. You can do whatever you want with the keyboard.
Yeah, I think by the time the mouse appears on the scene and becomes somewhat ubiquitous, I think that's kind of the final demise of the white pen as a pointing device. That the problem with the mouse, though, is it requires a small amount of training to get mastery. I don't know if you ever had to deal with a lot of mice from a lot of mice from different computer brands. They all have a little bit of a different feel to them.
Yeah, well, now they are all similar, but
I don't know
in the 80s. Let's see, my first mouse was something like 1991 or something like that, because prior to that, you got a computer, and most of the time they didn't include the mouse, only the Apple computers that you were used to that. They include the mouse into the graphical interface. It was like an important thing to have one, or it was included perhaps in the computer.
Right.
But prior to that, the PCs or Windows machines, it was kind of strange to have a mouse.
Yeah.
Previous to 1990, for example, 1991.
Right. Well, I mean, people always thought it was strange when I was telling them that I was using a mouse with my Commodore 64 back in the day. And they're like, what? That thing can have
a mouse?
And it's like, well, no, I mean, this was later on. I actually used my Commodore 8-bit machines well into the 90s because I had a Commodore 128 and a 1571 and a 1581 disk drive, and I was able to interchange data with contemporary PCs on some level. So I kept using it, and, you know, I had, you know, workable modem and so forth and so on. So I can still communicate. You know, I had a good VT100 102 emulator.
So you emulated the VT on the Commodore?
Yeah. Yeah, I used to, on my 128, I typically used a program called DesTerm, written by a guy named Matthew Desmond, which had pretty good VT100 and I think either VT102 color or ANSI color, if there's any difference, I don't remember. And that gave me a lot of usage for quite a while. Because I could, and the fact that it had, you know, the Z80 processor in it, you know, offered me a lot of, you know, free as in cost software that was written by, you know, the earlier hobby computer generation.
Okay.
You know.
So it works great. Even in the 19 for you.
Yeah.
You
until I actually started to actually need to be able to execute 8086, 8088 code, it still kind of worked for me day to day. And even though, and often for a lot of period, if I really needed access to an IBM PC, I had other alternatives, you know, either via school or work. And the fact that I, you know, could read and write MFM disks meant that I could do my work, you know, at school, and as long as I kept it, didn't use any sort of weird esoteric formats.
Okay.
Tried to keep things in the realm of plain text as much as I could.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great thing, because when the text editors change it into what you see, what
open
you
VoIP
get,
then
get
929.
Yeah. And then you get all sorts of proprietary word processor formats which are inconvenient.
Yeah, or you lose your previous work.
Yeah.
In any case. So plain text, it was the case also for me.
Yeah, worst case is you might have to reformat it. But it's at least always human readable.
Yeah, this is one of the great advantages of plain text. I really like this kind of only text ASCII or UTF-8 things.
Right, a simple UTF subset. So you have just enough characters to represent most languages, but otherwise basically backwards compatible with US ASCII.
Yeah, I got a 40-year-old data medium, which I have here. I still can't recall that data from them.
I know, I've done that too. I have work from, the Commodore 8-bit floppies, as well as stuff from like IBM 360K disks. That it's like, oh, I need it? Well, okay, I've got it. Still, I can still read that stuff. although higher density stuff doesn't hold up as well unless it's stored really well.
Well, you can, lose data because of deterioration in the media.
Yeah.
Or most of the cases, in my experience, has to be with humidity.
I agree that if it's, you're storing it in a garage or a basement and there's a lot of humidity, or the other side of the coin is, if it's in an unheated space, on climate, that doesn't have at least moderate climate control, that can be a problem too.
Well, this is the dead sentences perhaps this gets for this kind of operation. I don't know if they are going to be this get available.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually, one of the local NPR affiliates actually had a news blurb about a guy who still operates a business selling probably at least five and a quarter, 3.5-inch floppies. Some of them are new old stock. Some of them, I don't think he's doing new manufacturing. I think he's acquiring as much new old stock as he can, and in some cases he might reuse old media in some cases. I seem to remember somebody posting I think it's an Army Navy surplus outfit that also still has double sided double density disks.
Yeah, I read like perhaps 4 or 5 years ago that the United States nuclear facilities.
Yeah, I mean there are still systems. Yeah, and the idea sometimes is that then it is truly an air gapped system and it is employing a security through unavailability methodology. That
no hacker will.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, but it's going to be difficult to get anything into there because it's like A, you need access to the media, B, you need access to the hardware to actually write the media, and then B, you need someone with access to the actual facility to get it in there.
Yeah, don't drop any nuclear bomb with that. No, well, in any case, I hope this.
I think this news program also pointed at also the avionics systems, that if you've got older airplanes still in service, some of their avionics systems, their navigation and stuff were loaded off of floppy disks.
Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Floppy disk, mm-hmm. And broader systems, which are machines to meet, textile.
I understand.
So,
embroidery machines and.
Exactly, that is
the. Yeah. And things like that. Yeah, certainly that stuff. At some point in time went digital, and the earlier examples of them had, 3.5-inch diskettes for basically programming. It's basically next generation Jacquard weaving, right? although embroidery isn't weaving.
It was such a durability in the machine, in the mechanical part, in the embroidery system, and even the computer software is still, you can still use it using a simple emulator.
Right, and I'm sure there are other, there are in fact weaving, textile weaving machines that actually produce fabric that are probably computer controlled, and the patterns involved are probably as well computer controlled and probably have similar things where they were probably all manufactured. The ones that are in service today were probably manufactured in the late 70s, early 80s, and probably has some technology, based around that.
In order to make the design of the you can use plain text files,
mm-hmm.
marking with X the place in which you want the point of the
mm-hmm.
needle, and it works like that. But the problem is not the software who use that, but the diskette in order to insert the data into the machine. But now we are interchanging that with SD card readers. We are completely
mm-hmm.
compatible with the all format disk.
Yeah.
The 70 and 20 kilobytes drive.
Yeah.
No, the 100, the 1 and
megabyte. Yeah, 720, 144, 220, 2880, yeah. Typical PC floppy disk densities and formats.
Sort of emulator with an SD card. And you
I'm trying to remember the name of that product. There's a name brand for that. For that type of product, I know a few people that have used it, and they're basically designed to be floppy emulators that use modern, SD cards, or there may have been some intermediate compact flash variations on them.
Here they call that the Gotek or Gotek.
Gotek. That's the name I'm thinking of. Yeah.
And you insert a SD card. And you format that, and you get as perhaps 999 diskette, and you have two buttons to pass the diskette.
Yeah, I know. Right, the user interface could be better, but it's intended to be a direct drive replacement. So, the amount of area that you have on it to have a user interface is quite limited.
Yeah,
one of the guys in the local TI club has one in his machine. He's got a Gotek floppy emulator in it, and I've seen it work. I think he's got a variant that might have an LCD display in it, so it'll tell him what image it's on when he's cycling through. Also reminds me of the front panel partition selection interface on the Creative Microdesigns devices, the hard drive and the FT series for the Commodore 8-bit, that they had a front panel partition select mode that was sort of, basically made use of the front panel buttons a 3 or a 4-bit.
Yeah, the problem is that they are so so many different partitions that if you need to change from the partition 25 to the partition 700, you got to press 700 times the button, and your finger gets...
Yeah, well, I mean, I just went through that issue the other day while trying to put some money on my transit fare card. It's like, what denomination do you want to put on it? And it's like, I want to put $50 on it because I want to empty this gift card out. And it's like, well, you can either do 20 or 60. I mean, you can either do 40 or 60, but not 50 for some reason. So it's like you either have to do it in two transfers or you have to go into other amount and push the button 50 times.
Yeah. I don't know why they don't use or change a simple timer, and if you press a long time enough, they will get you...
Right, it'll just auto-increment at a faster speed, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know who designed this kind of thing.
Yeah, I know. people who have never had a formal information theory class, probably...
I don't know, these Chinese dudes, they don't use that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, no formal information theory class, and they think they know everything there is about user interface. And it's like, no.
You only have two buttons. Do more things with two buttons.
Mm-hmm.
But well, now, at least
yeah.
You have the system works. For example, Top says here that he must need one of these emulators for some Exonic sampler. And I think it works. I don't know if they can hear us, but I have heard of people changing the sampler disket drive with this kind of emulator from Gotex, and they work all right. So perhaps it's an option there.
Yeah, I think they just have to try it out. But I think if it's, you know, the interface is essentially MFM and it will handle, and they don't do anything really weird as far as, like, you know, spindle speed changes or, you know, some sort of weird non-standard sector size or density, then, you know, it probably will work. But, yeah, that reminds me of, you know, the super floppies on the, you know, the original super floppy on the Macintosh line where, you know, to get more data per track, instead of changing, you know, instead of taking the Commodore approach where they adjusted the right pulse speed in the controller, they adjusted the spindle speed in real time on the drive mechanism.
They hack their drive.
Well, it's not necessarily a hack. It's just a different alternative. I don't know if maybe they did that because of a, you know, if there was some sort of patent on it, on the Commodore technology, the way they did it. Although,
okay.
To take advantage of, you know, larger surface area on the outer tracks. But, yeah, that was kind of a weird thing where they adjusted the spindle speed. And then, of course, I think, you know, like the Commodore Amiga has, you know, unusual track and sector layouts.
Well, Jasmine, thank you for the nice chat. It's about time.
Yeah, it's about that time. This has been Vintage CompuTalk with Jazzmaz and Perone tonight. And,
thank you, everybody. And,
yeah. And I'm not sure if Synth Battle Royale is coming up next or not, but you might want to hang around for a few minutes after the hour and see if someone takes the lead on that.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Have a good night. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Open VoIP. Now you can be the DJ with SDF open mic. Get on the mic, get on the mic. Yo, 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 check it. Get on that mic, you are...